From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one: Google, Yahoo, LiveSearch, and Ask.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation today with noted critic Antonio Monda. What happened when he asked cultural icons, "Do you believe in God?" But first, the Environmental Protection Agency has turned down California's petition to set its own standards for greenhouse gas emissions from cars and trucks. That decision is a serious setback for California's bid to end run the federal government and set its own standards, with a goal to cut all greenhouse gas emissions in the state to 1990 levels. More than a dozen other states had followed California's initiative. The EPA ruling effectively turns down all of those states. President Bush, speaking at a press conference this morning, had this to say about the issue.
The question is how to have an effective strategy. Is it more effective to let each state make a decision as to how to proceed in curbing greenhouse gases? Or is it more effective to have a national strategy?
Juliet Eilprin is national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. She joins us now. And Juliet, how is California reacting?
Well, they're, as you might imagine, not pleased with the decision. They've been waiting for a long time for the government to make the decision. In fact, threatened to sue over it before because they weren't giving an answer, and obviously are indicating now that they will likely sue along with a host of other states and environmental groups to try to overturn this decision.
What are their chances?
Well, if you ask EPA's own lawyers, which is some of the information I had in my piece today, they say that they think the EPA will lose this lawsuit. They prepared a PowerPoint presentation for EPA Administrator Steve Johnson, who made this decision, in which they indicated that they thought they were likely to lose if sued.
Well, let's remind ourselves before we go further with this. Congress gave California the right to set their own emission standards back in 1967 because of all the cars and emissions there. Under the rules, they have to petition for a waiver, and California's plan was this first-in-the-nation global warming law. What, again, were they hoping to do?
What was California hoping to
do?
Yes,
yes.
What they were seeking to do is to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from automobiles, both in terms of the exhaust that comes out of their tailpipes and other emissions such as the air conditioning units in automobiles. And they were hoping to reduce these emissions 30% between 2009 and 2016.
Well, this is the first time in 40 years that such a request from California for a waiver has been flatly turned down. What does the EPA say? Why did they do it?
EPA and Administrator Johnson said in a telephone news conference with reporters last night that the reason that they turned this down is because they thought that, a national solution, as Bush indicated, was more effective. And in the new energy law that was just signed into law yesterday by the president, they do have tighter fuel economy standards. And so the argument that Johnson was making was that essentially we're dealing with this problem already as part of this energy law, and therefore it's unnecessary to have a stricter standard established by California and the 17 other states that have indicated they would adopt these standards.
That's EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson. Well, the federal standards that are mandated by this new energy bill, California apparently disagrees and says that their standards, California's standards, would have cut emissions more. So how do we reconcile the math?
Right. Well, I think that if you look at the analysis, and in fact, people were kind of scrambling to do this analysis yesterday, I think it's important to note that usually when the EPA makes this decision, they have documents that are called decision documents, where they lay out their legal reasoning and so forth, and policy reasoning. Those documents were not available yesterday and will only be produced next month, which kind of gives you a sense of how quickly they came together on this. I think it's pretty clear when you look at both EPA's back of the envelope analysis and the analysis that California has prepared that California would achieve perhaps even greater fuel economy standards by 2016 and certainly by 2020.
Yeah. Well, as we said, 12 other states have adopted essentially California's new standards, and governors in four other states have announced they plan to adopt them. So just briefly, we're assuming all these plans are on hold.
Exactly, because again, California has a special exemption, and it would only be if California was allowed to go through with this that all these other states could apply it on their own.
Okay, we'll see how this unfolds. Juliet Eilprin, national environmental reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, as Christians around the world prepare to celebrate Christmas and in many cases renew their faith, a noted critic asked 18 well-known cultural figures raised in many different faiths, what do you believe? Or more specifically, do you believe in God? The man asking the question, Antonio Monda, teaches film studies at the Tisch School for the Arts at New York University. He also writes for the Italian newspaper La Repubblica, and the New York Times calls him arguably the most well-known cultural figure you've never heard of. His new book, Do You Believe? Conversations on God and Religion, has answers from Saul Bellow and Ground Zero architect Daniel Libeskind to Toni Morrison, Spike Lee, Jane Fonda, and Antonio Monda joins us now from the studios at the Radio Foundation in New York with what they said to him. Antonio, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you break down the answers, you know, who said yes, who said no, who's in the middle. What were the numbers of the 18 people you interviewed?
Okay, let's say 5 called themselves believers, 6 atheists or agnostics, and 7 are in the middle.
Well, and even those who said yes, were you surprised at how people sort of danced around the answer? It didn't seem as if anyone, you know, came right out and really was a sort of a holy roller, if you will.
I was surprised and happily surprised by Saul Bellow. He immediately answered, yes, I do believe, and explained why. I know he was a believer, but I thought that he was hesitant or a little bit more reluctant to speak about this. Instead, he was very, very open about it.
Well, he was open, but he was very short about it. He kept saying, why do you want to talk about that? And said, you quoted him at one time, he told the Boston Globe, I don't want to bug God. I don't believe in petition prayers. You know, my requirements are trivial. He seemed to...
He said, I believe in God, but I don't bug him, which is a funny line. You know, he didn't like petition prayers, of course.
Yes.
But I see this line as a celebration of human freedom. What Bellow was telling me, I think, was God created us. Now it's up to us to become worthy of his love.
And he doesn't want to talk too much about it because he said then it becomes banal.
It's very risky, this ground. It's always dangerous to deal with this kind of huge issues without sounding banal or generic or vague.
Yeah.
It is true. But my point is, why we never talk about this thing? We always talk about the last film that we saw, the last book that we read, the last, you know, gallery show, but hardly we talk about these issues, which I think are much more important.
Who was it who said to you in the conversations, you know, when someone said there's no spirituality in film, and they said actually spirituality and the question of God is in all film?
Is a great film critic in Italy whose name is Virgilio Fantuzzi.
Would you share that opinion that there is in all film God?
In a way or another, yes. But this part of the conversation was also discussed with Martin Scorsese because, for example, I adore Luchino Visconti films, in particular The Leopard or Senso or Rocco and His Brothers, but I have difficulties to find God in his films. And Scorsese disagreed, and he explained to me very clearly why, even in The Leopard, that magnificent adaptation of the Tomasi di Lampedusa novel, you can find spirituality, if not God.
Let's talk for a second about Martin Scorsese. You say to him that you'd read a statement of his saying, I'm a lapsed Catholic, but I am Roman Catholic. There's no way out of it. And you ask him what he means. What did he mean?
He said, I don't know if I believe in God, but I'm Catholic. I believe that he meant that although he's not 100% sure to be an observant, faithful of believer, definitely his culture, his world, his personality is defined by Catholicism.
In your conversations, very intellectual.
Thank you.
You bring up Rabelais and Plato. And also, we get to David Lynch, and he brings up Groundhog Day. You know, Harold Ramis's film Groundhog Day. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, how he points to that.
Yes. Can I say that Groundhog Days is also one of my favorite comedies of all time?
Me too.
It is a very spiritual film. It's about a man played by the magnificent Bill Murray, whose character is a man who cannot move until he learns how to love. How can you be more spiritual than this? Again, Lynch is another believer, but is not exactly I don't share with him, you know, his ideas about God. He believes in transcendental meditation. He doesn't believe in institutions. And his idea of God, in my personal opinion, it's a little bit too New Age.
You asked everyone you spoke with if they had an image of God. Poet Derek Walcott imagines a wise old white man with a beard. Derek Walcott, of course, black. Writer Michael Cunningham sees God as a big black woman he remembers as a babysitter. He's white. What were other senses of, you know, what God looks or feels like?
Most of the answers, even among the religious or the one who are not sure about believing or not, most of the answers were, we cannot define God. And frankly, I do agree. I like the idea of Walcott imagining God like the God of Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, the classic image of God. And I'm amused by Michael Cunningham's identification with a nanny that he used to have when he was a kid. But I believe that we cannot define God.
By the way, we should say, you have a deep faith in God.
I'm Catholic, yes. You know, a few days ago I was reading a wonderful, wonderful book called Odin and Christianity. And there is a great definition about being a Christian. He say, Christian is not something that you are. It's something that you pray to become. So I don't know if I'm a good Catholic, but definitely I try my best.
Well, and what did you, what were your questions to the people you interviewed who said they not just were agnostic, the jury was out, but that they did not believe? Salman Rushdie, for instance.
Salman Rushdie, yes, he said that he doesn't believe at all, but somehow he believes in the soul. And then he told me, I believe in a mortal soul. So he recognized that there is something mysterious, but he doesn't relate that with spirituality, with religion, with God, with the omnipotent. There is mystery. And almost everybody among the atheists or the agnostics realize and recognize that there is mystery, even Grace Paley.
Now, Grace Paley, let's speak of this. You spoke with her before she died. And yep. Interestingly, she sort of, was sort of a silly question. I don't believe in God. But then said she had taken up reading the Bible.
Yes, she was extremely interested in the Bible, culturally. She married a man, second husband, who was religious and Protestant. And she started going with him to church. She told me not because she believed in anything, but because it was a cultural experience. And I also like that. I see this as an open door to something that might be the changing moment, the turning moment of your life.
That's critic Antonio Mondo speaking of the late Grace Paley, the writer and social activist whose short stories explored the struggles of ordinary women muddling through their lives. She was one of 18 thinkers who answered Antonio's question, do you believe in God? His book is Do You Believe? Conversations on God and Religion. When we come back, writer Nathan Englander, Elie Wiesel, Jane Fonda answer Antonio's question as well. And later today, Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul, his supporters have raised record amounts, largely without any input from Paul's campaign. So why do they do it? And what does he stand for? Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from Antonio Monda. He asked 18 cultural icons if they believed in God. He teaches film studies at the Tisch School for the Arts at New York University. And if you're a fan of filmmaker Wes Anderson, you may have seen him in the opening scene of Anderson's The Life Aquatic. Antonio plays himself interviewing Bill Murray as the fictitious oceanographer Steve Zissou.
That's an endangered species at most. What would be the scientific purpose of killing it?
Revenge.
Antonio, you used your interviewing skills in real life for your new book, Do You Believe? Conversations on God and Religion. And we left off talking about those on the fence when it comes to God. And for someone like you, a deep believer, how did it hit you when someone like Grace Paley told you that she went to church because it was a place to meet people, but she doesn't believe in God? You know, did she qualify as a spiritual person to you?
The one in the middle, I think they're not believers. They're only keeping their door open to fate, which is very important.
Who were some of those, by the way?
For example, Nathan Englander, and I like very much what he said.
Nathan Englander, he's been on this program. His story collection for The Relief of Unbearable Urges earned him much acclaim. A Jewish background. So what has he sort of said? What, that, you know, I'm just not sure.
He told me a very, very moving thing. He said, when I asked him, do you believe that there is life after death? He told me, I'm not sure, but if you ask me, where is my grandfather now? I will say in heaven. So this is a way of keeping the door open and definitely, you know, confronting a mystery that might or might not reveal something much bigger, much more important. Hmm. And he's not the only one. I mentioned before Michael Cunningham, Toni Morrison, Derek Walcott. I would say also, in a sense, Ford.
Richard Ford.
Yes, mm-hmm. You're right. Mm-hmm. He defines himself an atheist, but he gave me the most wonderful definition of fate. He reminded me of a line of the gospel, of the letter to the Hebrew by St. Paul, where fate mm-hmm. is defined with these words, the evidence of things unseen. And he told me this is something that's always present in his thoughts. And this is something that an atheist shouldn't say. It means that he didn't say no for good forever. Don't get me wrong. When I say in the middle, I have the greatest respect for them. And I have the greatest respect also for the no-sayers. What I don't like is an approach to fate that is, I like to call, a buffet kind of approach, meaning you go to a party, there is the buffet, and you take one dish that you like, another dish you take only half, and two you skip. This is not what religion is about. Religion comes from a Latin word that means bond. Religio, from ligare or religare, to be tied. So if you have a religious experience, you have to deal entirely with religion. Now there is a risk, a terrible, terrible risk, which is fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is an approach where you read verbatim what is written in the Bible or in the holy books, and then you act consequentially. But this is something that I consider risky, dangerous, has nothing to do with fate or orthodoxy.
Well, almost all the people you spoke with shared a disdain for fundamentalism in any form. And some fundamentalists listening might be saying, well, who appointed you? You know, but your mention of a buffet brings us to Jane Fonda.
She's a believer now.
Who is recently converted to Christianity. She's spoken about it in her book and here on this program.
What is most interesting for me in Jane Fonda's approach is the celebration of what Christ and the Christian Revolution did for the role of the women. She said that Christ is the first feminist. Hmm. And frankly, I do agree.
But, you know, in featuring Jane Fonda, and I'm sure, you know, others have said this to you, there are cynics who would say, you know, Jane Fonda is now embracing Christianity the way she did exercise.
It is cynical, let's face it.
Well, yeah, I mean, how did you feel her faith?
I believe that she was quite sincere, honestly. Her choice, her approach is not mine. I want to be clear on this, but I felt sincerity. Yeah. And as you know, she also had her long list of pain, starting from the suicide of her mother, that definitely, you know, formed and shaped her conscience, her soul. And I believe that there is a longing, a search in her life.
You end your book with Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, of course. He says, of course, he believes in God, but how does he still believe in God?
I was very moved by Wiesel's answer. He quoted a line, I think, from the Talmud that says there is not stronger fate than a wounded fate. He experienced the horror of the Holocaust. He has seen his people murdered. But he never lost his faith. This is a great lesson. God has nothing to do with the horror that men and women do. He is the first one to be horrified. And this is what Wiesel believed. And, you know, we don't even share the same religion, but I admire his choice.
That's Antonio Munda speaking of Elie Wiesel. Antonio teaches film studies at the Tisch School for the Arts at New York University. He writes for the Italian newspaper La Repubblica. Antonio Munda also would like America to have, you know, more of a conversation about God. He had many in his new book, Do You Believe? Conversations on God and Religion. Antonio, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Thank you so much.
And a quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, political dynasties, the Bushes, maybe the Clintons, should family members be barred from following each other into office? Also, a mother's Christmas gift to her daughter, a memoir of her life as a political refugee. And still ahead today, Amal and the Night Visitors, the first opera written just for TV a half a century ago. We'll hear how it inspires young singers today and how it sounded back in the 50s. After the news, Here and Now. A poll in today's Wall Street Journal shows that Rudy Giuliani has lost his national lead in the Republican presidential race. He's now tied with Mitt Romney, and Mike Huckabee is within striking distance of both. And where is Ron Paul, who raised a record $6 million on the internet in one day? Second to last, behind the 9% of people who polled not sure. Yet the libertarian Republican who wants to abolish the income tax and end the war in Iraq is attracting diehard supporters. Some say they're fringe. A man in a shark suit was approached at the New Hampshire debate and asked if he was a Ron Paul supporter. He said, "No, they're nuts. I'm just a man in a shark suit." But his supporters say they are leading the Ron Paul revolution. And here to talk about it all, Gail Chadwick, a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us from the Monitor Radio Studio in Washington. Gail, you've been out on the trail. How do people respond to Ron Paul?
It is one of the most interesting experiences I've had covering politics, because it's odd both watching the candidate and watching the audience. I mean, first the candidate. Usually when you see a candidate walk in front of an audience, there is a moment where they kind of gather themselves together. There's the opening, the greeting the audience, the, you know, the joke at the beginning, the big build-up, the great finish, mm-hmm. and then off the stage. Ron Paul looks as if he was involved in a conversation at the side of the room and noticed the microphone and just came over and continued the conversation. And he talks in front of a crowd exactly the way he talks to two people.
And what does he say? I mean, we mentioned abolish the income tax, end the war in Iraq. What else does he say?
It's all a riff on freedom. He can start out talking to a group about what's going on with inflation and the need to go back to the gold standard. He can start with the war and the need to have a much more humble foreign policy and to rein in adventurism and just focus on our needs at home. He can talk about gun control. He can talk about raw milk.
Where does he stand on each? Where does he stand on gun control?
As a general principle, anything that involves regulation of your life or constraining of choice or government that is larger rather than small, he opposes. Now, there are a couple of interesting exceptions to that, and I'm interested to see how it develops. One is his stand on abortion, because he is definitely pro-life. That is, he opposes abortion, which looks like a constraint on choice, which looks like it might violate libertarian principles. But he does it in a way that says, my real interest is getting control out of Washington, out of the Supreme Court, and back into the states. So in that sense, it fits into that template of smaller government rather than larger, but has the impact of constraining choice in the lives of individuals. So that's the kind of tension that he's trying to work out on that and a number of issues. But by and large, freedom is the one-word campaign that links together an extremely enthusiastic group of followers, but for entirely different reasons.
So he'd abolish gun control laws, legalize marijuana. But you say, you know, entirely different reasons. Conspiracy theorists, especially conspiracy surrounding 9/11, they've embraced him. Why?
Well, he is very focused on the idea that government has been captured by special interests. And I think it is a very small jump from that perception of politics to the black helicopter themes. Now, I haven't heard him get into that on the campaign trail. But this is a candidate that has written so much over his 30 years in public life. I think you're going to see in the weeks to come people digging around in the more obscure writings to find how much of a black helicopter sense does he really have.
Now, explain black helicopter.
Anyone who's seen that Mel Gibson-Julia Roberts film, Conspiracy Theory, will remember when big government black helicopters swoop down and kill people. Black helicopters come to be a metaphor for government conspiracy and overreach in many, many forms. I love a pamphlet that he wrote back in the 80s called Mises and Austrian Economics, a real grabby title. But he explains why it is he got into public life. And at the beginning of this pamphlet, he talks about the fact that a conventional political career with a real impact in Washington isn't possible for someone, in effect, who isn't owned by special interests. Huh. He pulls that straight out of Ludwig von Mises, and he says that's true about his life as well.
Ludwig von Mises, the economist.
Exactly, Austrian economist.
Well, we have to point out, though, you talked about how conspiracy theorists embrace Ron Paul. You can go walk into a room of Ron Paul supporters and there will be absolutely normal, not the conspiracy theorists, there will be absolutely normal Democrats, Republicans, independents, people who would never characterize themselves as in line with conspiracy theorists.
Absolutely. I was at a town hall meeting in Salem, New Hampshire, and with some of the first questions came from four men in the front row, about early 20s. They were day traders in Houston, and they had heard about a government move to regulate what they were doing, and they all got on a plane and went up to New Hampshire for a week to canvass for Ron Paul. Sitting next to them were two people who were there because they hated the idea the FDA was regulating the distribution of raw milk, which they thought was actually much healthier than pasteurized milk. Sitting next to them, people that were there because homeschooling was how they wanted to see education. They didn't want government involved telling them they had to vaccinate their kids. Sitting next to them were people that were there because they were concerned about alternative medicine. They just thought there was too much drugging. They wanted to be free to pursue other directions, especially for their kids, and on and on. Now, these people really didn't have anything in common with each other beyond the fact that there was something they believed intensely in. They resented government's involvement, and they saw Ron Paul as an answer. And, you know, he doesn't condemn anyone. He doesn't pick and choose among his supporters. He doesn't try to control them. That's the other fascinating aspect of this campaign.
Well, I was going to say, who's in charge of all of these people?
Well, no one. There is the official campaign, which until the infusion of millions of dollars recently was extremely modest. And then there is what they refer to as the shadow campaign. That's the supporters out in the blogosphere who are setting up Ron Paul meetings. They're doing fundraising on their own. They're even generating the graphics. I was talking to a man from Arizona who thought up the idea of this Ron Paul revolution graphic, which I think is one of the most striking I've ever seen in public life. And when he developed this idea, Ron Paul was not referring to his candidacy or his movement, such as it was, as a revolution. Now he is. And there was, of course, talk in the official campaign about how do you control all of this. And they described a meeting to me back in February where they realized that it was growing so rapidly that they wouldn't be able to control it. And one of the participants said, you know, we shouldn't try to control it. Ron Paul's entire philosophy is let people do what seems best to them, and that's how they're running the campaign.
Is there a danger of that backfiring? For instance, prior to the latest fundraiser, which took in $6 million, there was a previous one that took in $4.2 million last month. It was held on Guy Fawkes Day. It was commemorating the man who wanted to blow up the Houses of Parliament. You know, a little anarchism in that message. Is there a...
More than a little.
Yeah.
Ron Paul has been asked about that, too, and he does not condemn that choice. He says it wouldn't have been his choice. But then again, he is not controlling the people that are supporting him. That is against what he stood for 30 years.
Gail Chaddick covers Washington for the Christian Science Monitor. She's been tracking the Ron Paul Revolution, as it's being called. And Gail, Ron Paul ran for president once before, in 1988, as a libertarian. This time around, his campaign didn't even exist until this past January, and now he's raising record amounts of money. But he hasn't, as Mike Huckabee has, leapt over the other candidates. He's still far back in the polls. So what might happen if Ron Paul doesn't get the Republican Party nomination? Might he run as a third-party candidate?
He has said publicly, asked that question in one of the debates, that he is a Republican, he would not run as a third-party candidate. But I think when you raise the kind of issues you do that generate this level of enthusiasm, especially on college campuses, when he starts talking about monetary policy on college campuses, there are cheers and whoops. Now, who would have thought that?
And Gail, just explain that. Monetary policy, is it just abolishing the IRS?
It's not just the IRS. He's also looking at the Federal Reserve. He sees the Federal Reserve as big government that is out of control of anybody, and he blames their policies on interest rates for creating a housing bubble and devaluing the currency. The reason it's so difficult to travel abroad, or the dollar is worth so little, and there's a specter of inflation. Ron Paul blames the control of the Federal Reserve. And that's an issue that plays a little bit into conspiracy theories that are often popular on campuses, but it really plays into how young people are feeling. Do they think that what they earn is going to be of any value? Every 3 months, I write a story on what's happening with Social Security, the Medicare surplus, long-term sustainability. Nobody reads these stories. Nobody likes to think about them on Capitol Hill. But apparently college students think about that issue and realize that in the long term, the burden that is being put on them with the size of government now and the debt and entitlements and is crushing. And that on top of the student loans that they're carrying, and that there is just a deep vein of discontent about the world they're graduating into that makes issues that are arcane to the rest of us resonate on a college campus.
I just want to mention, in case people are saying the Federal Reserve, why are there, theories about the Federal Reserve? Well, there are a lot of theories that the Federal Reserve is unconstitutional, that paper money is unconstitutional. Are these the kinds of things that people are saying, that it's the Federal Reserve is owned and controlled by foreigners, that it's never been audited? Is this the kind of thing that people are saying?
That whole range of thought is focused on the Federal Reserve. Now, Ron Paul talks about accountability and oversight. He doesn't get into more conspiratorial theories, at least in his campaign so far.
And by the way, all of those that I just mentioned are myths. They're not true.
Oh,
that paper money is unconstitutional, for instance.
Well, actually, Ron Paul thinks that paper money is part of the problem, a big part of the problem. He wants to go back to money that has some intrinsic value, based on gold, for example. He's written two books on the subject, and I can't think of anyone in public life who has done so much writing on such a wide range of topics, especially when you think that, he's trained as a doctor. One of the things that has interested me about the response to him from libertarian organizations, they're concerned that he could actually damage what they call the brand, because there are aspects of his thought they don't agree with. They don't agree with his concerns about immigration. They don't agree with some of his trade policy, which they don't think is open enough. They don't agree with his stance on abortion. But most importantly, they don't agree with his focus in the past. There's a lot of, when you look at Ron Paul's economic writings and thought, there's a lot that harks back to the golden age before the Federal Reserve and big government. A lot of contemporary libertarians have this very optimistic view that is entirely forward-looking, and they feel that he's a little bit too negative and too backward-looking. And yet, here he is, surging in fundraising, drawing tremendous enthusiasm. I think he has certainly put his issues solidly in the public square in a way they have not been before.
Gail Chaddick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor and has been covering the campaign of presidential candidate Ron Paul. Gail, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
And go!
In a rehearsal room at Andover High School here in Andover, Massachusetts, about 36 members of the Young Opera Company of New England are transformed into shepherds in Giancarlo Menotti's Amahl and the Night Visitors. Amahl was the first opera written for television. It appeared live on NBC Christmas Eve 1951 and became an instant Christmas classic for a while. Now it's a staple of theater groups. It tells the story of the three kings following the star to the east, looking for the newborn child, Jesus.
You hear about the kings. Yeah, they come, but what did they do on their way? You know, did they meet anybody?
That's 14-year-old Jessica Plavik. She plays the impoverished mother of Amahl, the lame, mischievous shepherd boy.
I am a poor widow.
She's a tragic figure. She's like this poor widow, and she's got this crippled son who's a dreamer and makes up stories all the time.
Are you aware of its history? You know, have people been saying to you, I saw this on TV when I was... Yes, you know,
yes, they have. And I actually found a video of it on YouTube, and my mom and I were watching the original performance. I liked it. It was really cool. And the costumes kind of like raggedy, ripped up, dirty clothes that the people had. It was just really cool.
The 1951 cast reunited in 1952. This is a recording of that broadcast with Rosemary Coleman playing Amahl's mother, tempted to steal the gold the kings are bringing to Bethlehem.
That is an awesome aria. Probably one of my favorite arias is All That Gold.
I wonder if rich people know what to do with that gold.
The mother, she's trying to take the gold from the kings, but she's taking it because she wants to help Amahl. It's like this like clash of like good and evil.
She crawls towards the gold.
Oh, yeah.
The mother is caught by the kings, but forgiven. Now she wants to send a gift to the Christ child as well, but has none. Her son Amahl offers his only possession, his crutch, to the kings to take to the newborn child, an act that restores his ability to walk. It's a challenging role for a child.
My name is Lucas Tilianos. I'm 13 years old, and I play Amahl.
What'd you have to learn about Amahl to play him?
Well, actually, for some reason, my grandmother gave me a book for Christmas quite some time ago called Amahl and the Night Visitors. I put it on my bookshelf, never thinking that I'd be actually playing that young boy in like the middle of the night when Jesus was born. I'm just trying to put myself in someone else's shoes. Sometimes I'd look at my score and be thinking, now how am I going to be able to relate to when Amahl tells the mother there are two kings and what the mother's reaction is? Mother, I didn't tell the truth before.
That's a good boy.
There is not a king outside.
I should say not.
There are two kings.
What shall I do with this boy? What shall I do? What shall I do?
Oh, yeah, you're going to look somewhat annoyed and wishing she'd believe you, something like that. Even when I was little, I once saw this little Winnie the Pooh cartoon when Rabbit grabs a broom and hits something, and I'd pretend I was like some kind of policeman. If you get introduced to acting at a very early age, you can end up somewhere like this.
I'm Marie Stoltz. I am the artistic director and founder of this opera company. I actually played Amal at Southern Methodist University, and this is an opera that's just deep in my heart. This opera almost strikes the same chord that the Nutcracker does.
Did you grow up watching it the way...
Yes, I was born in 1945, and I saw it on NBC the first time. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And it's 50 minutes because NBC had a time constraint. And so there's this 50 minutes of joy and beauty and concern. And it's a really wonderful, wonderful opera. I love conducting it, and I love listening to it all the time.
What is it that's so compelling about it?
I think it's the moral value. You want your kids to know that some bad things can happen to us, and if you make this ultimate sacrifice, good things start to happen. Amal is Menotti. Menotti was born with a problem with his limb. It was restored in the springs.
So this is a story about another little boy who had his leg healed, as Giancarlo Menotti did.
Yes, exactly right. And he was struggling with the whole commission. He wrote this within, I think, 2 or 3 weeks. It just rings off the page. In Italy, the Magi come and give gifts, not Santa Claus or St. Nicholas. Menotti went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and he saw this gorgeous, gorgeous painting of the Magi, and it reminded him of what he and his brother had experienced in Italy.
The mother figure is one of the most crushing, this idea that my child, maybe my child, is the Christ child that you're looking for, that every child maybe is.
Well, you know, I think we all value children that way. And the fact that she gave that moral value to her child, to give that crutch at the end, and then he walks, is just one of those moral lessons. Menotti was inspired by his childhood, and the childish ideas come through. It's just, there's not 1 minute that's not joyful.
Oh, my darling, goodbye.
Oh, my darling, goodbye.
I shall miss you very much, very much.
Composer Giancarlo Menotti died this year at the age of 90, but his living legacy will be this story of the mother who ultimately gave the greatest gift, allowing her only son to go with the three wise men so that he might also thank the child in Bethlehem. For more on the Young Adult Opera Company, or to find out more about purchasing a recording of a Hallmark Hall of Fame broadcast of Amal and the Night Visitors, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.